swings a drive way back. Way back. Might be out of here. It could be. It is a tremendous home run. Better than 420 feet away from the plate, high into the left field bleachers, near where they go into the center field stand.
Well, my favorite Cub of all time, of course, is Ernie Banks. I was there for his 500th home run.
The wind is not a big factor. It's out of the southeast at 7 miles an hour.
And Ernie was a kind of a fella who could be so contagious.
Jarvis fires away. That's a fly ball deep to left. Back. That's it. Hey, he did it. Ernie Banks got number 500. A line drive shot into the seats and left. The ball tossed to the bullpen. Everybody on your feet. This is it.
His enthusiasm was so great. He'd take you along with him.
Hey, hey, holy mackerel. No doubt about it. The Cubs are on their way. Hey.
This is Cubs Confidential on the home of the Cubs, Chicago's WGN Radio 720. Here's David Kaplan.
Mr. Cub. In the long, epic history of the Chicago Cubs organization, in the legions of household names that have gained their fame and fortune at the corner of Clark and Addison, only one man has, or ever will have, dibs on the all-encompassing title of Mr. Cub. He's a man who has endeared himself into the very genetics of the Chicago Cubs and Cubs fans everywhere. A man who shattered baseball records on the field and barriers and prejudices off the field. A guy who suffered indignity and indifference because of his skin color and the crushing burden of being a trailblazer and a test case in a world that was not quite ready for him. Finally, a guy who would have every right in the world to carry a grudge around on top of his massive talent and abilities, but never did and still doesn't. Instead, this man chooses to smile and carry on. This man made his point with a baseball bat. This man was, and still is, all of the very best we expect from the game of baseball and from the team called the Chicago Cubs. He was, and still is, larger than life. And indeed, an outsized soul who remains even larger than his massive likeness, emblazoned in bronze as one of Wrigley Field's hallowed statues. He is now, and forever, Mr. Cub. And it is my honor to invite you to spend some time with him, as it was an honor for me to interview him. Right now, on Cubs Confidential. It is fitting that a state that lays claim to everything bigger produced Ernest Banks, born in Dallas, Texas, on January 31st, 1931. But Ernie was born into a time and place where his skin color made him all but invisible to the concepts of fairness, ability, and success. The early miles of a long, amazing story that winds its way through Wrigley Field and Cooperstown, and it's through those miles we'll travel. If you built a Mount Rushmore of Chicago sports, of the four greatest of all time, I've always said it would be Walter Payton, it would be Bobby Hull, Michael Jordan, and Ernie Banks. Now, there's been some amazing athletes that have come through this town. When you hear that and you think, wow, Mount Rushmore, Mr. Cub, how does that make you feel?
Well, I always felt bad about it, you know, that people gave me the adulation and the credit for all the things that I accomplished. I'm a type of guy that I like the attention going the other way rather than coming toward me. Not shy, but just like that. I like the other people to get the attention. So when I joined the Cubs and I played a game and I dressed beside Billy Williams and Ronnie and somebody come in and start asking me, well, you hit a home run, you did this. I said, well, Billy did this, Ronnie did that. I try to pass it on to them, to share this glory with them in the spotlight. I like that.
Tell the listeners something about yourself that would surprise them, that they went, whoa, I never knew that about Ernie Banks.
Well, it's not very hard in my life. Since I joined the Cubs in 1953 and walked into Wrigley Field and looked at the ballpark and I just said to myself, is this all there is? I looked out at left field and saw the bleachers, how small it looked, how close it looked to me. And I just fell in love with it. And it was just a wonderful place. And my whole life is built around giving and loving and sharing things with other people and trying to help. And a lot of people come up to me and ask me, say, you're a hero, you're a celebrity. And I look at them and I start saying, no, that's not me. I'm not a celebrity. A woman who has five kids and taking care of them by herself is a celebrity. And I always looked at that. And I always looked at women who came to Wrigley Field that had kids and brought kids to Wrigley Field. And I really admired them. So my whole life is tied around giving back.
I'm amazed to watch how you interact with people when you come from a time where, and I wasn't old enough, I wasn't born yet to see it, where because of the color of your skin, you can't eat in that restaurant, you can't use that water fountain, you can't ride that part of the bus, you can't stay in that hotel. It's just unfathomable to me. I talk to you, I talk to Billy. Two guys are as beloved by a fan base, as kind to people. No bitterness whatsoever for all of the BS that you had to deal with earlier in your life. Where did you get such a kind disposition?
Well, my mother, you're right about that, and my father. My mother was 16 when she married my father. He was 35. I just learned from them, just be nice to people, and they'll be nice to you. And, you know, don't try to create any confusion with anything. And, you know, it was just my way of life. And I was always around people that way. I mean, somewhere I go somewhere, I meet somebody that, hey, Ernie, I mean, nice to see you. You help me with my life, my career. I always come home to watch the Cubs play in the seventh inning, see you hit a home run or do something. I mean, just nice people. The goodness was surrounded my life, and it just stayed with me, and that's all I know. And
Billy sat right there, and he told an unbelievable story. He said, people really don't know that I quit baseball for a while. He said, I signed. He said, I wasn't allowed to eat in the restaurant with the team because of the color of my skin. I wasn't allowed to stay in the hotel. They would drop me off somewhere else. He goes, my teammates would bring me the leftovers or bring me food out of a restaurant that was supposedly whites only. And he said, I quit. I went home. He said, scout that signed him, who was African-American, came down to see him in Whistler. And he said, let's go down and take a walk to the park. He said, and there were some of Billy's friends. And they said, wow, Billy Williams, the great baseball player. And Billy said, the scout looked at him and said, you want to tell him or you want me to tell him that you're not tough enough to make it? You went through the same period of the racism that this country was just permeated with at the time. How did you, A, stay so positive? How did you deal with all of it? And you're looking back on it now, can you believe you made it through those tough times?
Well, I mean, it was very strange, very unique, because I came along with a man named Buck O'Neill, who managed me with the Kansas City Monarchs. And I just sit around and listen to him on the bus, in the restaurants, on the field, with his positiveness. And it just became part of my life, you know. Just, hey, this guy is really amazing. One day we was playing in Toledo, Ohio, and the game was tied, and Buck was a playing manager. He said, well, let me get a bat. I may go up here and lock my shoulders and hit this guy. And he did. I mean, he just said it and went and did it. And I learned from that. You know, positivism is the way to go and way to be in life.
Did you ever have moments, though, where because of the color of your skin, people automatically judged you in a harsh or negative light?
No, I did not. I kind of passed through a lot of that. I kind of ignored it, really. I mean, my life was just deal with the goodness in people, and that's it. I know there's bad, but just try to share my life with the goodness and see the goodness in them. And I didn't deal with that. I came along with the Cubs with a young man named Gene Baker, and Gene was a little bit older, but I learned a lot from him, you know, just being around him. And he had a method to let me experience things, and then he would tell me about it. We was playing in Mobile, Alabama, and we were sitting on the bus waiting to change because we couldn't change with the team. And I just thought of it. I said, well, Gene, I'm going to the bus station and get some candy. You want anything? He didn't say anything. So I got up, went out, walked in the Greyhound bus station, walked in the front. And I walked in there, and everybody looked at me like I was from some other planet. And then one guy came up to me, white guy came up to me and said, hey, you got to go around the back. So I walked out, went around the back, got the can, and came back, got on the bus, and Gene Baker was just laughing. I said, why didn't you tell me? I couldn't go in the front of this bus station. You'll learn. And that's what he said. You'll learn. I learned there that, you know, my place was just being where I was at the time.
Milton Bradley was here last year, and I had a chance to sit and talk with him one day. And as the season went on, he became more and more distant, and he said that he had experienced some racism. Jock Jones felt the same way. And then someone in the locker room said to him, well, wait a minute, the most famous Cubs player is Ernie Banks, and he's black. So is it because they didn't perform well? Is there an underlying tone of racism? What would you say to a guy like Milton or LaTroy Hawkins or Jock Jones who just for some reason couldn't connect with the fan base?
Well, I saw them. I didn't know them. LaTroy Hawkins, I had a chance to meet him. Milton Bradley, I didn't meet him at all. I saw him in L.A. and was with Tommy Lasorda and a lot of people that was working with him and talking to him about his activities. Jock Jones, when he came, I didn't know him. He was in San Diego. I didn't get a chance to talk to them or meet them. I just saw them play, and I had a lot of empathy for them in terms of their, you know, the way they play and the team was playing and the pressure that was on everybody. And I think it was just the pressure that was on everybody at that time. In 2003, we had a chance to win, and we didn't. And Dusty Baker came and created, he had a lot of adverse publicity. And, you know, it just the tension and the pressure that build up with bigger crowds caused people to kind of respond their own way. And where you play, at Wrigley Field, I think it's the way you play. We didn't win, but the way you play and the way you perform, if you give it your all and be kind and giving to the fans, sign autographs and all of that, and respond to them, they would respond to you. And as we got closer to winning and had a chance to win, it created a lot of tension. But now, it's a lot different. People come to Wrigley Field, and we win. We play the song. They put up the big W. It's not the end of times when you don't win at Wrigley Field. It's just people kind of enjoy being at the park, enjoy themselves, enjoy each other.
If a black player walked up to you, he's the best player in baseball, he's a free agent, and he said, Ernie, I see your statue there, you're Mr. Cub. I really am considering the Chicago Cubs, the Yankees, three or four other teams. What would you say to him as an African-American talking to another African-American if he said to you, do you think I'll fit in Chicago?
Well, I came close to that. We had a guy named Bill Madlock. He had a great year, won the batting championship. Mm-hmm. And I went in the Hall of Fame that year, so the Cubs asked me, who would you like to be have at the press conference we have in Chicago? I said, Bill Madlock. So he came and brought his wife, and I was, you know, talking to him directly about it because Mr. Wrigley wanted to trade him. They wanted to trade him because he wanted more money. So we talked a little bit, and he got a little bit upset, he called me an Uncle Tom in the papers, you know. Mm-hmm. They wrote a story about it, and you know, it didn't bother me. I just felt that, you know, he didn't quite understand. He was born in Southern Illinois, and he didn't quite understand. So he got traded, went to San Francisco. We got Bobby Mercer.
Right.
But it was just one of those unfortunate things, you know, that sometimes you have to deal with. I mean, that Ernie Banks, he's nothing but an Uncle Tom. He's not going to do this. He's not going to do that. But that wasn't my life. My life is just trying to give back and keep peace and be nice to people. And that's all I knew. Although they could be mad and angry with me, I just wanted to be nice to them and do the best I could.
You're listening to Cubs Confidential as we get to know more about Mr. Cub himself, Ernie Banks, in his own words, and the words of those who admire him. Here's a thought about the legend from a legend. The late, great Jack Brickhouse talks about Mr. Cub.
They tell one great story about Ernie over in Dubuque, Iowa, some kind of a fan club wintertime dinner. And this one fellow said, my 8-year-old boy is going to be brought over here by my brother pretty soon, and he's a big Ernie Banks fan. And we were at Wrigley Field last 4th of July, and you were playing the Phillies, and you got a home run in that first game. We got lucky. We got good box seats near the dugout. And so, boy, we were really privileged to be near that home run. Now in comes the 8-year-old, and they bring the 8-year-old up to meet Ernie. And Ernie looked at him, and he said, excuse me, but were you at Wrigley Field last July the 4th? I started to get a little, yeah. He said, were you sitting near the dugout? He said, well, yeah. He said, in that first game against the Phillies, when I got a home run, he said, I swear that I got that home run on account of you being there. I said, you know, this kid looked like a good luck charm to me, and I'll bet you I can hit one for him. Well, now, if that boy lives to be 9,000 years old, do you think he'll ever forget Ernie Banks?
There's been some unbelievable announcers come through this town. Tell me about your experiences working with Jack and with Harry Carey, who he didn't call your games, but you got to know Harry.
Yes, I did. I saw him in St. Louis, and, you know, I just around them. I'm just learning something. I long learned something with Jack. One time I was on the disabled list, he asked me to come up and work with him and say a few words or something, and I did. I mean, I had no training in doing it, but I did. I mean, I just learned. I couldn't wait to be around him to learn about people and learn about how to express things and listen to people and understand players and interviews and so much from him. And the same thing with Harry Carey. I learned from Harry Carey that his love for this game was just unbelievable. The game and the people who played it, the fans who came out. And he started something that was very, very big, and that's singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, the 7th inning at Wrigley, and it's become a signature of the park itself. And people love to do it, and the fans love to get up, and no matter what the score is, and if we're behind, they say, let's get some runs. I mean, it was just a fun place for people to come.
I'm here with Pat Hughes, the voice of the Cubs. Pat, you've been around the Chicago Cubs for many seasons. You grew up in California. Give me your earliest memories of watching Ernie Banks.
When I was about 11 years old, it would have been about 1966 or so, my brother John and I, we would always try to sneak into the clubhouses at Candlestick Park. We always got turned away by security or police guys. They'd say, kids, get out of here. One day, the Cubs were at Candlestick, a Sunday doubleheader. The Cubs had taken batting practice. We had an idea of sneaking into the clubhouse following the ball players. As soon as batting practice was over, we jumped out on the field. We hid behind the big ball players like Ron Santo and Ferguson Jenkins, and we were able to successfully sneak into the Cubs clubhouse. We walked right over to Billy Williams. We collected baseball cards. We watched every game on television, so we knew who guys like Ron Santo and Billy Williams and Ernie Banks were. Leo DeRocher was the manager at that time. But we immediately went over to Billy. The Cubs had played the Dodgers on national television the day before. And we start peppering Billy Williams with these questions. And we were, kind of pests, really. But Billy couldn't have been nicer. He did not run us out of the clubhouse. He was patient with us. He was friendly. And after about 5 minutes with Billy, we recognized Ernie Banks, the great Mr. Cub. And he, in typical Ernie Banks fashion, said, "Hello, boys. How you doing?" I mean, he was outgoing as you couldn't believe how nice he was. He shook our hands, Dave, and I was struck by how strong his hands were, almost crushed an 11-year-old kid's hand. But he was so friendly and, "Hi, boys, how you doing? Nice to see you. Welcome. Let's play two." Just the way you thought he would be. And I'll never forget that moment. I wish that I could tell you that I met Ron Santo that day. We saw Ron across the clubhouse. He looked like a giant. His pants were real tight and his arms bulging muscles. I did not meet Ronnie, but I saw him. We all knew who he was, of course. We saw Leo DeRocher on the other side of the clubhouse, and we tried to stay away from him because we knew he would run us out of the clubhouse if he saw us. But we did spend some time with Billy Williams and Ernie Banks. It's a memory that I'll cherish forever, and I still laugh and tell Billy Williams, I say, "Billy, thanks for not getting rid of us that day."
Tell me your memories of Ernie as a player. You saw him as a shortstop. You also saw him as a first baseman.
I saw many games when he'd play at Candlestick against the Giants. I still remember the way he would grip the bat. He would hold the bat, and his fingers would always be tightening and loosening around the handle as he was waiting for the pitch to come in. But he had very quick wrists. The bat would just snap through the hitting area. The ball would just jump off his bat. But he played with what I would call a love of the game. A love of the game. And there are a few guys that play like that. Kirby Puckett always played that way, I thought. Willie Mays played that way. Ernie Banks, you could just tell they were completely in a different world, enjoying every single minute that they were playing on the field. And I think as a young player, that's what makes you fall in love with the game, when you see a guy that loves the game that much.
Jackie Robinson was the first player to break the color ban in Major League Baseball. Did you spend time with him prior to coming to the big leagues? Did you develop a friendship with him? I've never really heard you talk about him.
Yes, I didn't talk about him because he was such a, you know, remarkable man. He came here to make a speech, and I found out he was coming to make a speech, and I went over and was in the audience. He made a speech, and he chatted with me, and it was unfortunate when we lost him. His family called me to be the pallbearer at his funeral, and I was just shocked over it. You know, I didn't think that nobody cared, nobody knew about me and my relationship with Jackie, because I toured with him in a barnstorming tour in his early days with the Dodgers, and I was with Kansas City. And I remember in Jackson, Mississippi, Jackie came up to me and said, "Hey, you can play in the major league. You got good hands, and you can, you know, can catch the ball. You can make the double play." And I was surprised at him telling me, "So I'm going to recommend you to the Dodgers." And he did. And I went to the arm and came back, and Dodgers scouted me and all that. But Jackie was just a remarkable person to me. I wanted to follow his career after I got close to in the mine. Jackie was president of a bank in Brooklyn. He worked for Chock Full of Nuts, a coffee company. He got into housing. He did so many. He got into the civil rights movement and changed a lot of things in the South. I mean, they wouldn't cover any of the things and meetings and the marches in the South until Jackie came, the newspaper. And Jackie was just, he was just everything to me. And the odd thing about it, we were born on the same day, different years. January 31st, 1919 for him, and 1931 for me. We just had a lot of feeling for each other. And I followed him and listened to him and watched his career, watched when he retired, what he did, how he got involved in things. It was just amazing, the admiration I have for Jackie Robinson.
You said that he recommended you to the Dodgers and they scouted you. You're a two-time MVP, a Hall of Famer. What happened? How did you end up a Cub?
Well, let's see. The Monarchs played at the White Sox Park, and I just happened to have a good day. And the general manager named Whit Matthews started talking to Buck O'Neill and the Monarchs about me, and they wanted to sign me up. And one morning, Buck O'Neill called me and said, "Hey, you got to be down in the lobby at 7 o'clock in the morning, you and Bill Dickey." And we didn't say anything. I told Bill, I said, "We got to be in the lobby to meet Buck O'Neill. What does he want? I don't know." So we go down, get in the cab, ride out, looked up and saw this big sign out here that said, "Welcome to Wrigley Field." "What? We're at Wrigley Field." Bill looked at me. We went inside and walked up to Whit Matthews' office, and he started talking. He said, "Now, you're going to play for the Cubs. You're going to join the Cubs when the season's over. Bill Dickey, we're going to send you to Cedar Rapids, blah, blah, blah." And that was it. It was just so fast, so smooth. It was unbelievable. I called my dad that afternoon. I said, "Dad, we're rich." He said, "What's the matter with you? You losing your mind?" "Yeah, we're rich. I signed with the Cubs." He said, "What?" I sat with the Cub. So he read in the papers the next day. He said, you did. I said, we are rich. it was an amazing time in my life.
If you look back, what was the first contract? How much did you get? You hear guys today, I mean, Soriano makes $18 million a year. What did Ernie Banks sign his first deal for?
It was $2,000, and I was just overwhelmed at that. Although my name is Banks, I never was overwhelmed by money. I mean, I just wasn't. I mean, I was fortunate enough to play golf with Bill Gates and Warren Buffett at Augusta about 3 years ago, 5 days with those guys. And I learned from that, you know, life is just not about money all the time. There's certain things. It just doesn't fit. Money does not fit. It's there. It's necessary, and all of that. But there's so many good things that you can learn from not having. And I heard Bill Gates say that he wished he didn't have all the money that he has. You know, he didn't finish Harvard. He got out and started his own thing. And what I learned from those guys is that find something you love to do. And stick with it. That's it. That's the only way to get success and gain success. And I see now, and I'm learning from this giving back cruise that I'm going to take from Bill Gates. He has given most of his money away. I mean, it's like he didn't want it. He don't need it. I don't need it anymore. It's too much. And I learned from those guys, just giving. And it's an amazing thing. It's a real joy to give. You learn so much to give. You learn so much about people when they give and help each other. And I've learned from all of that that this country, and I know they talk about Wall Street and all these different kinds of things, but this is a giving country.
This is a very special Cubs Confidential as we talk with the legend, number 14, Ernie Banks. In a moment, we find out more about Ernie's playing days at the place he himself named what we have called it ever since, the Friendly Confines, about the teammate who told him, play two, you can't even finish one. And we find out what song Ernie had cranked up heading home from Wrigley after hitting his 500th home run. It's all coming up as Cubs Confidential continues. Our chat with Mr. Cub Ernie Banks rolls on next.
Hey, hey, holy mackerel, no doubt about it, the Cubs are on their way.
Let's do it again here. Get up a little bit. Put it back.
Welcome back to Cubs Confidential. I'm David Kaplan. Through all the famous names and faces I've been lucky enough to meet and interview in this job, only very rarely do I get to sit down with someone who's been a legend and inspiration for me personally since my childhood. This is one of those moments, and I invite you to enjoy the second half of our very special chat with Mr. Cub, Ernie Banks. Where did the whole Let's Play 2 thing start? You always came up with a rhyme, Cubs are going to shine in 69. And I was a kid in this town. I mean, we just went nuts for it.
Well, it was in July 1967. We were leading the division and all of that. And I it was a warm day, and everybody was getting kind of tired around the middle of the year. And I was feeling so good. I walked into the locker room, and everybody was getting dressed slowly and all that. And I said, boy, it's a beautiful day. Let's play two. And they all stopped and looked at me. This guy's crazy. Well, Jimmy Enright, a writer, was in the clubhouse that day, so he picked it up and wrote about it. And it stayed with me for years, you know. It's a beautiful day. Let's play two. I get letters from it. People talk about it wherever I go. And it kind of highlighted my life.
when you look back on your career, someone said to me, Ernie Banks was Alex Rodriguez before Alex Rodriguez. He said Ernie Banks was one of the great shortstops the game has ever seen. Then you dealt with some knee injuries. You end up moving over to first. You hit over 500 home runs. Where did you get more joy, playing shortstop, playing first base?
I got more joy playing shortstop. And it came when Sam Jones pitched his no-hitter against Pittsburgh. And I was playing short, and the ball came over my head. We had a guy named Walt Morin playing left field. He made a shoestring. He made a great catch to save the game. And that was a real joy for me to be at shortstop. I kind of felt that I was in charge. I felt like a senator, a congressman, a leader, to see the signs from the catcher and playing alongside the second baseman and the center fielder. And I loved playing that position. It was just unfortunate I had knee problems and had to be shifted to first base under the College of Coaching system. I don't know if you remember that.
I remember.
But we had no manager one year. Mr. Wrigley started the College of Coaches. So,
what was that like to play for? It had to be bizarre.
it really was bizarre. But I kind of adjusted to it pretty well. We played in L.A., and Elvin Tappy was the manager at that time. He came up to me and said, here's a first base glove. You're going to play first base in San Francisco. And I just got the glove, and when I started catching ground balls and all of that, and then I ran into the wall in San Francisco and hurt my knee trying to catch a pop-up. But it was different, you know, learning a new position, doing the season on a different leadership, and it was different, and one time we played in Houston. It was about 80 and 90 degrees, and I hit a triple in the game playing first base and fainted. And here come all the players. I mean, they wouldn't let me let go of it. You're talking about to play two, and you can't even play one. So I never lived that down. But it was hard, and I ran, and it just fell out. I fainted. I ate some pork that morning, and it kind of bothered me and caught up with me during the game. And I had to come out of the game, but they still ride me about it. They wrote me about it for about 5 years.
1969, Ronnie says it still eats at him. It drives him crazy. He hates the city of New York. He hates the Mets simply from 69. Take me back to that season, the magical joyride that the city was caught up in, and then how it eventually didn't quite get to where you wanted it to be.
Well, I mean, it was a very strange time in my career. It was toward the end of it. I was about 39, 40 years old, and we had a great leader in Leo DeRocher, and we played great, exciting baseball. Ronnie was there playing great. Billy Williams was playing great. And when we got to New York, I had mentioned this to Ronnie. He dressed right beside me, and I said, now we're playing in New York. Now, New York have writers come in, and the photographers come in after the game, so let's kind of keep cool after this game. But anyway, we lost the game and came in, and he was just so hot. I mean, he's a fierce competitor. I learned a lot from him. He's a guy that once he get on that field, he wanted to win. He'd do anything to win. He played hard to win. But he kind of exploded and got all riled up. And Don Young was the center fielder. He left. Pete Risa was the coach. He left with him. I mean, everything was kind of way out of balance. But I knew it was going to happen before it happened because I was trying to quiet it down, being the veteran player.
Right.
So Ronnie got really up. I mean, he's just so upset. But it kind of got out of hand, and, you know, the media picked up on it and made it sound real bad. He had some unpleasant things happen to him, some threats and all of that. And it just blew out of hand. But I kind of saw it was coming and tried to curb it. I talked to Vince Lloyd, one of the announcers, and now we got to stop this here. I mean, this is bad. We're losing, and everybody's falling out of shape and getting all upset over everything. And he said, yeah, I mean, just try to keep everybody calm. And I just couldn't do it.
Ronnie, you played with Ernie Banks. In fact, you were telling me the story a little while ago that your first game when you showed up with the Cubs from Double A, called up to the big leagues, Ernie came up and tried to relax you before that day.
Well, you know, in those days, and me coming up at the age of 20, and of course I had a very good spring with the big league ball club, but they sent me out. And coming up to the big leagues in Pittsburgh, June 26, you know, you feel like you're a loner, even though you've played with these guys in spring training. They were different because you were taking the place of one of their friends that used to be on the ball club, and they weren't real friendly. You had to prove yourself before. And I happened to be out on the bench in uniform. I was the only one there watching. Hitting, you know, Clemente and all the guys, Grote, Mazeroski. And Ernie came and sat right next to me, and he said, are you nervous? And I said, oh, yeah. I said, I'm a nervous wreck. He said, well, look at Bob Friend and Vernon Law like they're Double-A pitchers. And I said, Ernie, that's easy for you to say. But that moment, he took me under his wing. That particular day, which was unbelievable to have him on my side. You still had to prove yourself that you belonged in the big leagues, especially in those days at the age of 20, and they had 20 minor league teams. So you didn't know how long you're going to be there. But I had a lot of confidence. I felt very strongly I could have made the team in spring training. And when Lou Boudreau took over the ball club, that's when I was brought up.
Your memories of watching Ernie as a player. He was a tremendous shortstop, two-time MVP, and a great first baseman.
I saw Ernie, and that's Ernie had a lot to do with me signing with the Cubs. In Seattle, he had the game of the week on Saturday, the National League on Sunday, the American League. And any time the Cubs came on, there was something about Wrigley Field and Ernie Banks. And it was the way he stood at the plate. And so relaxed and twiddling his thumbs and just nothing but line drives. And he just had a gift. And when I did meet him for the first time, you know, you met a guy that is the same today as he was when he played. He's a beautiful person. And, you know, he's kind of crazy, too, you know, which is wonderful because he's always talking about something that's not important.
Your thoughts on watching him as a power hitter? I mean, one of the greats of all time, 512 home runs, I believe. And he was a guy that, as Pat Hughes told me, his bat was so quick through the hitting zone.
It was. And Ernie, sure, he hit a lot of balls on the Waveland Avenue. But you go to any ballpark around, Ernie just hit the ball as far as you had to hit the ball. He was a line drive hitter. And he was a pull hitter and a great one. Very tough to strike out. And the one story, Jack Sanford, who was a Giants pitcher, we were in Wrigley Field, and that was my first year. And Ernie was up at the plate, and I had heard that he had hit, I think, 12 home runs off of Sanford. And I think Sanford hit him about 11 times. And this particular day, Glenn Hobby was pitching, and Ernie was up, and he got hit. Excuse me. He got hit in the back, and he went to first, but it got him pretty hard, so they took him out. He came into the dugout, and first time I've ever seen him get upset, meaning he said, I'll give anybody $100 if they get that guy. And I wanted to leave the dugout at that time to go out after him.
Get the $100.
Sanford, yeah. $100, you kidding me, in those days? That was big.
If you didn't play for the Cubs, if that guy had never come and gotten you out of the hotel and brought you to Wrigley and signed you, was there a team that you grew up saying, yeah, if I ever made it, I'd play for them?
Yeah, it is. I mean, Jackie Robinson was that type of person, and a lot of players say that. Black players, Jackie Robinson was the one. And the
reason, you'd have gone to the Dodgers.
Yeah, I would have gone to the Dodgers. because he was there, and you know, with very Branch Rickey and all those people were more in support of all the black players that came there. Joe Black, Jackie Robb, Jim Gilliam, and
Campanella.
All those guys was just like, wow, they were all just one. I said, gosh, I'd like to be on that team to be playing with those guys. And then I played against the Dodgers the first time they came here in September 53. They had always won the pennant. And I came out early and was standing there on third base. And Jackie came out early, and he ran all the way over to third base. And was just so happy. I still see his face smiling. I'm glad you're here. You know, play hard. And the only advice I'm going to give you is listen and you'll learn. And that's what I did for about 3 to 5 years. I didn't say anything. I didn't talk to anybody. I mean, Jack Brickhoff wanted to do interviews, and I don't know what to say. I don't know how to deal with it. Jackie told me to listen and learn throughout my life. That's what I've been doing. I'm talking more now than ever before. But that's what my life was about. Listen and learn.
In terms of playing with Ronnie, Glenn Beckert, Billy Williams, the locker room and the times on the bus and the times away from the playing field had to be some of the funniest times you've ever spent.
Yeah, they were fun. I didn't laugh about them, but they were just fun being around these guys on a day-to-day basis. I went by to visit with Ronnie. I was always interested in being close to him because the spring training one year, he lost his mom and dad coming down the spring training.
Right, in a car wreck.
And I saw how he dealt with that. I mean, he was just so strong inside with losing his parents and the way he stood up and you know, and it faced it. You know, he didn't run from it, didn't get sorrow of it. He would just hurt him. And I just kind of got around his life and I went to visit him in his home and met his family and his kids. And he came to one of my birthday parties. We just came pretty close through that. You know, and at that time, you know, blacks was not associated with whites and all that. And I saw at Wrigley Field that we played together and lived apart. I mean, I live south. Most of the white players live north. But we played together at Wrigley Field. So I wanted to match up and get to know them better and like the Dodgers when they were in Brooklyn, New York. I mean, a lot of those guys were very close, Pee Wee and Jackie and all that. They had a unity of that. And I saw from that, I mean, to win, you got to have that kind of unity and love. Everybody got to like each other just one time. That's the fans, the writers, the coaches, the managers, the front office, everybody. Got to like each other just one time.
Biggest disappointment you ever had to deal with in your life, whether it's baseball, in your personal life, was there something, a tragedy, something that you went through, you went, that was hard?
That's hard. A loss. But I say this now in love. I mean, playing for the Cubs when I played, we played all day games. We didn't have many people at the ballpark. And somehow in my life, I got accustomed to losses. In my own personal life, I lost my brother. I lost my father. When I went in the Hall of Fame, I lost Mr. Wrigley. Lost my sister. I had a lot of losses, but, you know, playing for the Cubs, I understand how to overcome losses, that you care about it, but not that much, and that you remember something good about the person you lost. You know, my dad, Mr. Wrigley, my mother, my sisters, my brothers, I've kind of got tough around it, getting tough over it because of, you know, my plan was that way. I mean, we lose a game in Wrigley, a tight ball game in the seventh inning. You walk out of the ballpark and said, I care about this, but not that much, and come back the next day and be ready to go.
The people out there wonder, do you have kids? Do you tell us about your wife? What is your life, your personal life like?
It has been like my baseball life. been married four times. I always married women that I didn't know, and they didn't know me, but I wanted to get married. Marriage has always been a big part of my life. I can't understand why, but and I got married when I was in the Army. They said, what are you going to do when you get out? I said, I'm going to get married and play baseball. And that's what I did. I got married and went and played baseball. But it didn't fit in my life at that time. And so it went on and on and on. But then my twins was born. I have twin boys. And I have a girl. She's 47. And have a adopted child. Mm-hmm. And it has been difficult. I would like to have been like Billy Williams and Stan Musial and some of the other players I played against that stayed with one marriage all their careers. And my mother was saying this to be a joke. She's gone now. I said, Ernie, you've been married more times than anybody in the major leagues. I didn't know she remembered that, and I started laughing. You're right about that.
Going through those four marriages, there are highs and lows. I'm a divorced guy who's remarried and now very happily. But were you ever at peace with yourself when you weren't married? Or you're the marrying type?
I always thought about that. You know, I'd like to have been like Jackie and, you know, Musial, as I said, and Billy Williams and a lot of guys who played in the major leagues and stayed married to one woman their whole career. I'd love to have done that. I'm just a marrying type.
You're listening to Cubs Confidential. Ernie Banks, the Cubs shortstop and first baseman, the baseball trailblazer, the Hall of Fame mainstay. We've heard a lot about history from a man who created more than his share of it. Now we hear more about the man from the man. And in the quiet, contented glow of later years, how this Cub who has accomplished so much still isn't finished.
When you were playing for the Chicago Cubs, you always thought you'd win. Now it's 2010. They haven't won yet. Can you describe to someone, if they didn't know anything about the Cubs, they came here from a foreign land, and they said, what is it with this Cub thing? They never win, and it's sold out every day. What would you say to them about the enormity of being a Cubs fan?
It's interesting to me. Funny that you mentioned that. I heard Mr. Wrigley do a piece on this, and he talked about it. He said, now, come out to Wrigley Field, sunshine, fresh air, and you see a major league game beside. He didn't promote the team or the players. He promoted things that was going to be there. The park's going to be there. Going to be sunshine sometime. You're going to play a game. You don't know what he's going to come out. So that's the way, to me, Wrigley Field is. People come there when I was playing just to be in the park for the sunshine and the fresh air, and then they would see a game. And through the years, that's where I always looked at it. I met a lot of the people used to come, Sarah and Clara, and it wasn't that many there. And Pat Piper was always announcing the game and giving the lineup, and people would take out their pencils and scorecards. Have your pencils and scorecards ready. We'll give you the correct lineup for today's game. And they get their pencils and scorecards and they kept score of the game. They were really in the game. They were highly educated people. We had Ladies' Day, we had Senior Citizen Day, had Barber's Day, and you know, I kind of got caught up in all of that, the learning process of meeting people and the friendliness of Wrigley Field.
Cubs have a young shortstop now by the name of Starlin Castro. He's 20 years old. If he sat here with you and said, Mr. Banks, could you give me some advice? Some people say the streets of Chicago can swallow up many a good athlete if you're not careful. What would you tell him about playing for the Cubs, playing Major League Baseball, and to be careful to keep everything in perspective?
Just love the game. That's it. Love the game. And that's what I would say to Castro. Just love the game. And my dad told me many years ago, Ernie, keep a job. My mother said, save your money. It's just two things. So those are things that I live by. But I would just tell him, just love the game. And he can really play. He has the natural twos to play, his swing, His instincts for the game is just there, and the rest of it will come now, because I played prior to agents. Now, you know, all the players have agents, so they have to kind of follow their guidelines. But I know the other parts of his life that he will take care. I mean, he's from Dominican Republic, and Dominican, most of the players from Dominican, they take care of their families. They are very family-oriented, so I'm sure he'll be close to his family, his mother and father, and so forth.
Last thing, music. You've always liked music, a good bottle of wine. Who are some of your favorites if you're just going to kick back and put some music on? What are you going to listen to?
Well, it's going to be a guy named Nat King Cole. When I hit my 500th home run, I was driving down Lakeshore Drive, and the song came out. It was a cloudy day. Bring out those lazy, hazy, hazy days of summer. Can we play that?
Days of summer. Those days of soda and pretzels and beer.
Da 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 da. So it just got me more relaxed in that age. Da 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 da. And I met Nat King Cole and was really proud of him because he was one of the first blacks to have his own show. And I remember talking to his wife. He said, well, Nat called me the other night. He was in New York getting ready to do a show. The country's not ready for the dark. Speaking of himself.
Right.
To her. But I loved his music, his singing, his style and everything. I think he spent a lot of time in Chicago.
So you put that song on, driving to the ballpark and hit number 500 that day.
Yeah. Nat King Cole. Bring out those lazy. Can you play that?
Could always be here.
But here's what I did. I mean, this is something private. After I retired, I wanted to know what I want to be when I grow up.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Chicago State to have a study done on my life. So they did all the research and everything, and they came back with the results. And the results show that my whole life now is giving back. Philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
That's my life. Philanthropy. I don't have a whole lot of money or anything, but I just want to give, you know, my good deeds and good feeling to
smile.
Help people and smile and help their lives. And I looked at this in my life. When people talk about money, I mean, I always say it's not about money. It's about you and your life and singing your own song.
You wish that summer could always be here.
You've been listening to our very special Cubs Confidential with the Cub who will forever be unsatisfied to just play one baseball game. A heartfelt thanks to Mr. Cub Ernie Banks for taking the time to join us. Cubs Confidential is a production of the home of the Cubs, WGN Radio 720. Produced by Chris Duffy, with help from Justin Weiner and Jordan Burnfield. Special thanks to Pat Hughes and Ron Santo, together with Matt Bolts at Wrigley Field. I'm David Kaplan. Make sure you join us again next time as we sit down and get to know yet another player in the game of our lives, Chicago Cubs baseball. Till then, go Cubs, go.